All right, we're talking today with John DeLange, co-founder at strategicfundraising.com, about his 12 rules for fundraisers. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Dan. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
I am thrilled to have you on the show, and I was really excited to read some of these rules, and I saw a lot of overlap with things we talk about here on Dynamic Nonprofits all the time, and unsiloed fundraising and trying to help fundraisers be more well-rounded stewards for the modern reality of fundraising. So I am really excited to get into to talking about them. And but first, we would like to get to know a little more about you. Would you mind sharing with the audience your origin story in fundraising and just your story about how you ended up where you are today and why you think this is an important initiative that you're working on?
Sure. So my story actually begins on a farm. My family has a strawberry farm in West Michigan. And I learned so many life lessons and interacting with customers and managing teams and trying to deal with paperwork and reporting structures, running payroll for our pickers on the strawberry farm. And that was something that, to be honest, I couldn't wait to get away from when I graduated high school. And at that point, my intention was to get into politics, which I did for a few years. And that skill set, Dan, is very analogous to entry-level fundraising work, making lots of phone calls, dealing with events and volunteers, and generating enthusiasm for causes and issue advocacy. So that was the shift that I had as I graduated with a communications degree and then began doing fundraising for Christian nonprofits in the Midwest. I was director of development for a local group of healthcare centers, pregnancy centers that we raised $1 million for the first time when I was there, and then took on a major gift caseload for a national organization, and then over time became the national direct mail and digital fundraising manager for Summit Ministries, which is based in Colorado. So we teach Christian worldview to young people and write curriculum for Christian schools. So I helped them work on their mail program, all of their digital engagement with any supporters. We've had some great results over the last 6 years working with them. And in that process, I just have a heart for a lot of small organizations. I've been the director of development at a small organization, and getting to a point where I was doing some consulting, being asked to coach some other organizations. And I've got to this point, as we look at the landscape that we're in 2024, there's no shortage of tactics. There's no shortage of new initiatives. People who've been in the industry for 20 years or so, maybe they're just starting realizing that they need to have new initiatives or new tools because the old strategies aren't working as well. So the question becomes, how do we actually raise more money through real relationships for our mission while building trust and ultimately not being overwhelmed or burned out? And so that's the impetus for the 12 rules for fundraisers. I'm writing an essay series, releasing one each month on specific topics to help organizations think that through.
I love that. And it definitely rings true to me what you're saying, because there's any number of tactical ideas, channels, strategies out there. There's an abundance of information, a lot of it free online. And I see a lot of the conversation heading today is there's more opportunity than ever for nonprofits, but there aren't necessarily more resources. There aren't necessarily more people available to do these things. And sometimes I feel like the small to mid-sized nonprofits, they look at a lot of these things that we talk about and they say, well, I'm not a top 5% charity. I can't possibly do that. And I think big ideas, big visions, big strategies, they're accessible, but where nonprofits need help is they need help focusing and prioritizing and figuring out where do I spend my time and where is what is going to ultimately have the most upside to it. So I really appreciate what you're trying to do here, because I think there's a huge need for it, and getting nonprofits and fundraisers to learn to prioritize and balance all of these different resources is just going to help nonprofits of all type go to the next level. I wanted to circle back. I did know about you growing up on a strawberry farm because I listened to your interview on another podcast. So I came in with a question that I tend to ask people who have a different backgrounds who come into the fundraising world. Is there anything from farming experience that you feel prepared you for life as a fundraiser?
That's a fun question. So one of the things that a lot of people don't recognize about, well, strawberries specifically, is that you have to go past a entire harvest season after planting and cultivating that specific fruit before you can have a profitable harvest. So I'll draw a couple analogies in just a second, but if you bear with me getting into the weeds here, strawberries, you have to plant them, and it's more than 14 months later before you can have a proper harvest. And so there's an immense amount of work that needs to go into the field prep, soil prep, the cultivation of the actual plant itself, helping it grow from one specific plant to an entire bush or row, and then going into the process of harvest at the other end. There's no mechanized solution for it, since they're very low bushes and fragile fruit. And so the analogous part of it for fundraising is, and I recognize that it takes more than a year in many cases to finally get to a place where a relationship has gotten to a point where you can move into a harvest season. And that's, I've worked with organizations that get to September or October of a year, and they realize that their budget is lacking in that calendar year, and they say, let's put together a plan to close out the year strong. And sometimes there are relationships that have kind of bloomed or grown in the background that you can then move into a harvest phase. But more often than not, it's at that time that they need to start building those relationships. And I'll poke the bear a little bit here with you, Dan, too. We talk about AI and AI-enabled fundraising and all these different things that are cutting-edge strategies. And so often, we just need to go back to the basics and plant the seeds and cultivate the real relationships with the key supporters of our organization. And that's what creates the trust that helps them move from maybe emotional resonance giving to relationship trust and transformational giving over time.
No, we're big fans of poking the bear and speaking truths and soapboxes. And it's reflects something I've said, that there are it's a fascinating conversation, and it is amazing where AI could take us as an industry. But my feeling is that there's so many things very similar to what you just said that nonprofits can do today to improve relationships with their donors. And the thing that I usually respond to those conversations, those futuristic conversations, is that if you're not calling your donors today to say thank you, it might be premature to think about how AI is going to revolutionize your nonprofit, because there's so much of those tried and true basics that you're leaving on the table as is. So I love that back to basics conversation. And I agree entirely that it's very easy to get excited and lost in what's to come. But it shouldn't be at the expense of the here and the now.
Yeah. And as we have a new crop of millennial and potentially Gen Z fundraisers joining the industry, I see a lot of people who are very adept at relational fundraising and in the same age cohort as many of our donors, right? So with the average age of the donor being 65 plus for significant donors of organizations, many times there's major gift officers and directors of development and vice presidents who are in that same cohort, but that's going to be a change. And if we replace those positions in our organization with people that aren't at the level of relational cultivation that they ought to be, those relationships are going to suffer, and we're going to lose out on the wealth transfer that's going to happen between the boomer generation and those that are coming behind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was a great answer. And I didn't tip you off about that ahead of time, but I mean, it's a super dynamic process with lots of different things that can go right and wrong, and it's a long tail. So I see plenty of applications to fundraising. I've stood on my front lawn and recorded videos about how fundraising compares to growing a lawn. So I think anything like that where there's this dynamic long tail process, it prepares you for the fundraising world. So that was a great answer. I appreciate you taking us inside there, and something to think about the next time you go shopping for strawberries. 14 months. I did not know that, but it definitely gives me a greater appreciation for what goes into it now. One question which may tie in to your rules is, and I did want to get at this because of your experience with Summit Ministries. I don't know if this is still the case, but generally that tends to be an older donor base in the ministry world. Is that still fair to say? So I think your experience is really valuable hearing you talk about connecting direct mail and digital and the role that digital and other channels can play for cultivating relationships with donors of all types, regardless of how old they are. Is that something is that something you care to weigh in on from your experience and the role digital has played?
Sure. So one of the things that we've made a focus of at Summit over the last 6 years is surfacing relationships that can go from online into an offline context. And so I owe a debt of gratitude for this mindset to our VP, Aaron Atwood, who intentionally 6 years ago began doing a cadence of supporter retreats over the course of the past 5 or 6 years. The organization's fundraising has more than doubled. And it's a process of identifying those people and asking for their engagement. And so I follow tactics in that way, asking for one-to-one email replies to some of our nationwide supporter engagement emails. And those things don't scale very well. I recognize that when I'm writing email copy and asking for our supporters to send back a note of encouragement on Valentine's Day for our internal staff, that more than likely we're going to have a whole raft of content that's then sent directly to our vice president's inbox. And I appreciate his intentionality and his openness to accept that, because that can just become unmanageable. But that's the sort of thing that help those individuals feel like they're going from just one more email address on the other side of an ESP software to someone who's participating in the mission. And we were able to, in that case specifically, we were able to then turn around and read some of those supporter encouragement notes on Valentine's Day to our internal all hands staff meeting. And so that's
That's
one of the ways that
fantastic.
we're bringing the online relationships into the real world.
That's fantastic. So, and the application there for any nonprofit is if you use whether it's email or social media to create a positive experience and positive engagement, that does have downstream effects, regardless of where those donors make their gifts, that those things do matter and they do go a long way towards building a more meaningful relationship with donors. And those are some great examples that you just cited there about the power of email to be super personal.
Yeah, it's and I'll piggyback off of that with a specific story as well. It's a process where so many times the tendency is for organizations to say, well, we'd like these people to support us, but we're the ones that are doing the work, right? And I've worked with families before where they were at a five-figure giving level in an average year. And then over the course of 2 years, they moved up two orders of magnitude in their giving. So they made a multi-year seven-figure commitment. And as I talked to them and was thinking back on this process, we invited more than one generation of their family members into participation with our organization. And then as I asked them about their giving decision later on, they said, hey, when we were at one of your supporter weekends, we met people who were actually running the organization, And we had middle manager level speakers at that retreat weekend where they were talking about their area of responsibility within the organization. So it wasn't the CEO spinning vision, although he did that. And it wasn't the vice presidents going through the giving portfolio, although they did that. It was an individual who's actually running a program saying, hey, here's what I'm seeing day to day in fulfillment of this organization's vision and mission.
Wow, that's incredible. But it makes sense that the people who may be closest to the fundraising, that are on the ground, that are doing the work, that they may have the most important information and maybe the most moving stories about interactions with donors. That's great. I appreciate you sharing that. And maybe some of this gateways well into our conversation today. You have 12 rules for fundraisers. Can you kind of start with the nexus for this, or what do you hope that fundraisers get out of this? What do they get better at doing? And then we can go through some of a couple of the rules that that you'd like to highlight.
Sure. So we're releasing a essay a month on strategicfundraisingplan.com to our email audience there. And this is really about how can you, as a fundraiser, raise more through real relationships and not be overwhelmed by the profusion of tactical possibilities that are available to you in the age of AI-enabled fundraising, multi-channel communications, social media, ad buying, and connected TV, and direct mail, and all of the things that are out there for many small shops. When you have a limited number of chairs that you're setting out your entire fundraising strategy over, right? So two or three people sitting in your fundraising shop, doing every tactic can become unmanageable. And so who are those people that are sitting in those small shops? And how do you manage your time for the greatest effect? So that's the ethos of the essay series. I kicked it off with the first one called Manage Your Beliefs, because at the core of any tactic that we're going to do or any campaign that we're going to run, it comes down to the limiting or delimiting beliefs that we have as fundraisers as we go out to interact with our supporters. So one of the things that I vividly remember as a part-time fundraiser doing my first role in Major Gifts was looking through my lapsed donor report and finding someone who was running a multi-billion dollar corporation. And I was confronted at that moment, Dan, with a crisis of belief. I looked through my list, I Googled the name, I realized that this individual was only one state away from where my desk was. And I knew in that moment that I needed to take action, but it was very hard to overcome this thought process of, well, what if they don't want to hear from me? Maybe there was a reason why they stopped giving 5 years ago. What if I have to defend this expenditure to my vice president and nothing ever comes of it? Or I don't have all of their contact information and I don't even know their preferences, even if I did. And so the belief structure that we have to have as fundraisers is positive and forward thinking, so that way when opportunities like this present themselves, we confidently move forward and offer people the gift of participating in a mission that they care about. Because giving ultimately is a gift. It's an opportunity to express our values and find joy and meaning in the resources that are under our care.
Yeah. And what I like about that first essay is that it really goes at the heart of the scarcity mindset, which plagues our sector, which is not to say that nonprofits should embrace risk or move fast and break things, but there is managed risk. And in that situation, you're talking about going to meet with a very wealthy donor. And yes, there's cost associated with that, the travel. I think it's a very healthy thing to challenge the industry on, and breaking out of that mindset that expense or overhead is always a negative thing. And instead to frame it by looking at what the potential upside is of this investment. It may not work. You didn't know what was going to come of that relationship, but the juice was certainly worth the squeeze and taking the risk. And I think we have to move in that direction as a sector and embrace some risk and learn to manage it if we truly want to grow and change fundraising relationships, because there is going to be some risk associated with that.
Absolutely. And there's some good information out there about having a barbell strategy when it comes to managed risk. So operating in the management side of risk, where we're specifically watching our overhead and taking the actions that we know are going to produce a result. However, there's an argument for allocating maybe 5 to 10% of effort and cost or investment into strategies that have low odds of success, but very, very high upside when we do succeed, right? Being overexposed on high reward, high risk strategies is a recipe for, you know, if they fail, for someone who's looking at the numbers at your organization to say, well, why did you spend all of your time on this high reward, high risk strategy that didn't actually pan out? But if we never live in that mode, we're giving up the opportunity for a reactivated relationship that, in this case, from the story that I was describing to you, resulted in an 850% increase in that individual's giving over the course of several years.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I'm a big fan of having an R&D mindset. Some of the content that I've written about, I've framed it as fundraising X, modeled after Google X program, which is all exploratory projects that have a low probability of success, but potentially are transformative. I think that's a really healthy mindset, and also a lot less scary when you frame it from that set of take 5% of your budget, maybe 10% of your budget, and put it into these areas that are potentially transformative. And that can dramatically change an organization, everything from something you're talking about donor visits to direct mail tests. It liberates people to think a little bit bolder and freer when you're not constantly stressing on what is the ROI of this going to be, and instead looking at what can this turn into if it's successful, and embracing the possibility of failure and learning from it. I think that's a really healthy mindset for growth-oriented nonprofits.
Yeah, and as we're talking both about strategy and about the fundraisers who are implementing that strategy, Dan, one of the things that was really powerful for me in moving beyond my inherent introverted nature and worry about how I was going to be perceived when I called someone who had never heard my voice before, or I didn't know if they were actually going to support the organization. I learned this from a speaker when I was 17 or 18, and his mental armor in those specific moments was, I'm going to leave this interaction, this phone call, this visit, this event that I'm going to, with either a story or a friend or both. And that mindset frees up individuals. And I've been there. I wrestle with call anxiety and going to that spot where, hey, I'm going to leave this phone call with a story or a friend or both. And yeah, there's absolutely times when you get a negative response, or you know, something doesn't work out, and those become stories. And more often than not, you end up with a friend on the back end of taking a courageous leap forward into something that you're confident will further your mission when it is successful.
What advice do you have for mid-level fundraisers who hear what you're saying, fully embrace it, and are trying to figure out, how do I talk to leadership about manage or about embracing managed risk and doing exactly what we were talking about? How can fundraisers who are working at nonprofits, or even working with clients who are nonprofits, advance those kinds of discussions?
Sure. That's a great question. I think one thing that we want to think about in that conversation, if you're in a position where you're advocating to leadership, hey, I need more time or effort or budget in order to pursue potentially transformative strategies at the organization, one thing to think about is, hey, as nonprofits, we're in an environment where everything's been tried online in some form or another, and we need a way to help move up in the mental in the mental categories of our best supporters, right? And so taking a step forward that might be a bit of a risk, but indicates to our supporters that we want to be in relationship with them. We want them to have specific knowledge of our mission, and we want to relate with them as people, not only as a representative checkbook. That can be really powerful, and that's going to help organizations stand out when there's no shortage of tactics. Many organizations are doing similar things, and we're seeing diminishing returns on certain things that were cutting edge just a couple of years ago.
So extension of that, how about leaders at organizations who are concerned what donors will think about this type of mindset? Or you may know from your own experience, having so much interactions with donors, how do donors actually feel about organizations that are more investment oriented?
Sure. Well, I think there's an aspect of this where you want to honor the preferences of the supporter that you're working with, right? Some people are going to appreciate the specific attention that is paid them, right? They have an expectation of excellence and of concierge level fundraiser care. And then there are other people that, you know, it's up to the fundraiser to use their discernment and identify these moments. But I've worked with people that say, hey, I don't want to receive any specific recognition from the organization. I don't want you to send me a thank you gift or a bouquet of flowers at a giving milestone or at any sort of special recognition, because I want those dollars to be leveraged towards the mission. And of course, those conversations need to be handled with care, because some of those people think that everyone should have their same preferences. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. And as a fundraiser, one of the other concepts in the 12 rules for fundraisers is embracing your limits. And as a fundraiser, we need to recognize that we need to be spending time. Our time is limited. That's a key one in this concept. We need to be spending our time on those relationships that have the capacity and the interest in supporting our organization at a transformational level.
This topic came up on a webinar that I was just hosting, and one of the guests shared surprising feedback about just how receptive high capacity donors were to conversations about capital intensive investments. And it comes back to donors who support nonprofits at any level, but especially at those higher levels. They want these organizations to grow and to do great things. And in many cases, nobody has just had that conversation with them about, this is what we want to do, but this is the investment that's going to be required. It's going to mean hiring additional staff and things that may not look like programmatic work, but ultimately will lead to more of it. People are very smart, and I think most donors want to be part of, on the ground level, of those sort of transformative solutions. But I think many organizations are still afraid of having those conversations.
Yeah, it's a delicate conversation. I have worked with individuals, like we mentioned earlier, who moved their gift up by two orders of magnitude because of their involvement in one of those capital intensive supporter retreat weekends, right? And that, to some, you know, that's not the place that you can start, and that's okay. We can still do deep care. We can do things that don't scale. We can go to one of our top supporters' grandson's basketball game or granddaughter's soccer game or lacrosse game or whatever it happens to be. And those are the things that indicate to them that we want to see them and be in relationship with them as a whole person, right? And you're right, Dan, savvy savvy supporters recognize that relationships are not, they're not built only online. And sometimes we need that sense of community among the people that have high capacity, high interest, and are participating in the organization to really move their giving forward, to have to see that lift from year over year. And that I've worked with family foundations that make gifts specifically to the organizations they care about to do weekends like this, that then catalyze giving amongst a larger cohort that's one level down from their giving capacity.
Oh, that's incredible. And every story like that is helpful for changing the paradigm and getting more fundraisers, more nonprofits open to having those kinds of conversations, because like any other form of fundraising, you don't know unless you ask. And I agree. I think there's more donors than not out there that are willing to entertain those conversations and may reward nonprofits for their honesty and their willing to have them. In the few minutes that we have left, you mentioned your first essay, which is now available. Want to give us a preview of what else is coming down the pike, or are there any other of the rules that you'd like to highlight in the few minutes that we have left? Of course, we'll link to all of your information in the show notes.
Sure. So one of the things that kind of ties a lot of these concepts together is when you're in a position where you don't know what to do, if you can take one action as a fundraiser to help a supporter, a volunteer, a staff member, a board member feel like a hero to the mission of the organization in a workday, you're on the path towards fundraising success, right? And that's the pre-work that must happen from someone who's sitting in a revenue generation chair at the organization at minimum one time every day. And those are the types of things that they stack up over time. They're the tiny habits that James Clear talks about in Atomic Habits, that we're going to shift the conversation at our organizations by helping instantiate a culture of gratitude and care and appreciation for the people that are enabling this mission. And some people give their time, sometimes people give their talent or their treasure, and those we need to be recognizing those things on a consistent basis. Another concept that I would highlight from the upcoming essays is this idea that as fundraisers, oftentimes we're called to manage up and we're asked to help our CEO or the president of the organization care well for a specific relationship or set of relationships. And I've worked with presidents who have a real hesitancy around fundraising. And I've heard horror stories of other organization presidents that will fly to a city and then take a media interview instead and stand up a 6 or 7 figure donor visit because they would prefer to have something else going on. And as a fundraiser, those can be really delicate situations. So having a mindset there that executive fundraising is really a dial that you can help dial up or down. Not every CEO is going to be ready to sit down for an hour coffee and present a giving agreement. But if we want to dial that back, potentially they would make one phone call or record an iPhone video, or we can draft a text for them to send and take that as a downsell, if you will, for their time, because it can be a delicate conversation to say, hey, I need you to allocate some significant percentage of your time to fundraising.
Great advice. I love your remarks about the importance of building a culture of gratitude and how a lot of things start with that is making sure that donors feel appreciated and know that they're part of the solution, and how those tiny habits can scale and over time transform an organization. Not the easiest question to leave you on, but I think an important one, and one I think you'll have a good answer for, is how do organizations measure success both in the short and the long term if they buy into that and want to create a culture of gratitude? It's not something that you're going to see an immediate ROI on, but how do you measure your success over time?
Sure. Well, I think there's this jumps into the conversation, Dan, of leading and lagging indicators. And I think as a sector, we are addicted to the lagging indicator of gross or net revenue on whatever calendar or fiscal year that we're measuring it on, right? And an organization that's really focused on a culture of gratitude is going to have leading metrics that are designed around how do we interact with people prior to and soon after their point of generosity. And so that's something that I'm working on with my team at Summit Ministries right now. And I'm advising the organizations that I work with through strategic fundraising plan to think about how do you have an on-time thank you requirement plank in your scoreboard? Is that something that you have a specific timeline for? Let's say any gift over $500 is thanked within X days, or you know, then you move it up in time for higher gifts and down in time for lower gifts, whatever it happens to be. However quickly your organization can have that on time thank you process in place, I mean, you're going to help your organization stand out from the crowd. I made a test donation to a national organization just the other day, and I haven't received an emailed thank you acknowledgement yet, 2 days later. And unfortunately, that's too common in our sector.
Right. And there's a cost to that.
Yeah, there's absolutely a cost to that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I think emphasizing the importance of gratitude and expedited gratitude, and that it's not just a one-time thing. It's not just a thank you letter. It really is a mentality that you embrace in all your interactions with donors is something that if nonprofits have the patience to stay the course, it's something that will pay for itself many times over the course of years because it transforms your relationships. One more question on the topic of relationships. Is there a litmus test that any nonprofit leader or fundraiser could use today to evaluate how healthy their relationships are with donors?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that we start to, at least you want to start asking about donors, and the litmus test may be maybe even too simplistic, but when we start asking questions about, hey, do I know meaningful personal information about the supporters that give to my organization at whatever significant level you'd like to define. Maybe that's $1,000 a year or $5,000 a year or $10,000 a year. The question is not which CRM are we tracking those touches in, or how many people are opening our email. The question for those relationships is, do I know their wife's name or their husband's name? Do I know their kids' names? Do I know which organization they work for, which other organizations they give to? Do I understand where our organization ranks in their philanthropic priorities and how they make gifts, how they like to hear from our organization? I think those are the types of questions we ought to be asking to determine whether or not we have a healthy program built on real relationships.
Love that. A relationship audit of sorts. I love those tangibles that can get people to go down a checklist and say, do we know these things? And hopefully open some eyes about the shortcomings and also the potential for developing deeper, more meaningful relationships with donors and what that can mean over the long term. John, yeah, go ahead. I was just going to thank you, but
don't sell yourself short. If you're listening to this and you realize there are individuals in your file that you don't have those answers to, what that gives you an opportunity for is moving intentionally into those conversations and offering that individual the opportunity to know and be known by your organization. And that's what I counsel organizations on is, that is going to move your program forward. That is going to resource your mission when you are intentional about filling in those blanks on the most important funding relationships that you have.
And it's never too late to get started, as your example highlights with your lapsed donor who you were able to find. it's never too late to try to build on those relationships. John, this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I think it's super valuable, and it really gets to the heart of a lot of the issues facing the sector, and also how do we move forward? How do we enhance and improve fundraising and the donor experience from here? And I'm grateful for your thought leadership on this topic. I'm a big fan of yours on LinkedIn, where you produce a lot of great content. If listeners would like to get to know more about you and your work, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Sure. LinkedIn is a great opportunity. If you search John DeLange, you'll find me there. And people can also register for access to the 12 fundraising rules, how to beat tactical overwhelm and raise more through real relationships at strategicfundraisingplan.com.
Fantastic. We'll link to everything in the show notes. John, best of luck with everything. Please come back sometime. Keep us posted on how your work's doing. But we certainly appreciate your time.
I appreciate it, Dan. Thank you.